Welcome, everyone, to tonight's Inner Circle call, and I'm so excited to have my good friend Nick Bradley. Nick is an amazing guy. He's a PGA Tour mentor and Ryder Cup specialist. He's worked with some of the top golf players in the world, people like Justin Rose, where he started working with Justin when he was 125 in the world, got him to number five. And then Nick had some life events that took him off course, and we'll talk about that tonight. But he's the best-selling author of two amazing books, The Seven Laws of the Golf Swing and Kinetic Golf. And I have some stories around one of those books that I'll share tonight that's really powerful. Nick's average client he works with is 9 to 10 figures. You got to kind of think about it when we start talking 9 to 10 figure golf clients. 10 figures is a billionaire, and he has a few of those. And I'm also proud to say Nick's part of our recent book we just did, The One Thing That Changed Everything, and we have 10 Inner Circle members in that book: Robert Helms, Ron White, Sheldon, Stephen South, Erica, Matt Baller, Frank McKay, Marco Santarelli, myself, and of course Nick. And we didn't say it publicly, but we hit number one in 16 categories. It was just really phenomenal support. So thank you guys all so much. So much support. Really appreciate it. And woke up one morning thinking, you know, we need to donate all the proceeds to a charity. So I found a great charity, Grace, which is here in Grapevine. I've supported them in a lot of different ways in the past. So excited about that. We just really hit a home run with the book, and really proud of the book and proud of all the stories. And Nick has an amazing story in the book. We're going to touch base on that too. So tonight, really want to pick Nick's brain, but I want to leave plenty of time for you guys to ask questions. But let me welcome Nick Bradley.
Thank you, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a testament to our friendship over the years, and I'm very excited to be part of that great book.
Yes, I was thinking about that tonight, because I think Jim Rohn was part of that, right? You were a Jim Rohn fan.
100%. I mean, you know, the parallels between, you know, professional sport and business and life. I mean, there's a thread that runs through all three of them. And what Jim was amazing at doing was coming up with those commonalities that tied, you know, how is business inseparable from life? It isn't. How is sport inseparable from life or business? It isn't. So there is a common thread between each three of them.
Yeah, so true. And as people are hearing you maybe for the first time, let's go ahead and say, I mean, you're from London, right? You're from across the pond and
that's right.
Grew up over there. And so maybe Jim was a little bit of a late discovery for you. In fact, I want to really talk about what you're doing now because you're doing some amazing things. But can you give us a little bit of history growing up and how you got started in golf, some of the early years?
Absolutely. So I was actually a late starter in golf. I took up golf at 16 years old. I was actually a very good swimmer. I won on what you guys would call a state level. So, you know, I was the best swimmer in North Carolina or California, you know, on a state sense. So I was a very good swimmer. But, you know, I took up golf at 16. My brother and my father and I went and played golf at a place on the same day. And at 16 years old, and within two and a half years, I think it was, I had got down to a scratch handicap, which meant that I basically was breaking par every time that I went out to play, and that was after 2.5 years. And the reason for that was I took up golf relatively late. I had friends of mine that were already very good at golf. And so I just basically read every book, I watched every video, I had tons of lessons, and I did the self-development thing. You know, if you want more, you've got to become more. So I absolutely immersed myself in that process, and because of that, I became a better teacher, I had a great observation, a great eye for what needed to happen for other people to get better. So from that perspective, I just developed into more of a mentor and an instructor. And, you know, I took it up at 16. I started working with my first tour player at 19 years old. And, you know, at a very early age, I was exposed to top-level golf. People like Sandy Lyle, Seviano Ballesteros, Nick Faldo, who, you know, is a friend of mine. You know, I mean, it's so, you know, I was very lucky. I got blooded very young into that sort of development stage. And then I moved out to America for the first time in 1994. I worked for David Ledbetter, who was my first golf mentor. He was working with the best players in the world. And it was a great journey for me. You know, again, for the second time, I got to hang around these great athletes. And it wasn't necessarily the technical knowledge, and this could be the first lesson of the evening. It wasn't necessarily the technical knowledge that I learned from all of these great people. It was the way that you communicated. And if you could communicate on a high level with a lot of people, then you had a really good chance of influencing them. So, you know, that journey went on, Kyle, really, and I ended up coaching 8 national amateur champions. I ended up coaching the best golfer in Europe, 1 world number 1, 2 world number 5s, and Ryder Cup. It's been an amazing journey, and I've had many mentors along the way, and I've got lots of stories to tell.
Fantastic. And, you know, as you're talking about, you know, what a quick study you were, but how disciplined you were and that made you a great teacher, did kind of remind me of what you talked about in your story in The One Thing, where you talked about the three phases to learning anything permanently. And I thought that was really powerful when you go through that. Can you touch on those three phases?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's your expertise that basically mobilizes your ability to see, you know, change in yourself and others. And, you know, it's experience that's the wisdom that to look back and gather. You know, I think today, you know, we're drowning in knowledge, but we're starving for wisdom, Kyle, you know, and I think that's so true, because we have everything at our fingertips, yet it's still the ability to get out of bed in the morning and make the decisions that that influence our lives. I'll give you a great example of that. You know, Everybody on this phone call has 1,440 minutes in a day, okay? That is, you know, 24 hours in minutes, right? So 1% of that is 14 minutes. 1% of your day is 14 minutes. Now, why not take 1% of your day to create the other 99? That is, I mean, that's very powerful, and that's something that I coach a lot of my tour players, elite players, and elite business people, is that it's called the 1% solution. So, you know, 1,440 minutes a day, 1% of that is 14 minutes. Take 1% of your day to make the other 99. That's what I'm talking about when I say that, you know, we're drowning in knowledge, yet starving for wisdom. It's that sort of thing. So, you know, I was also very lucky, you know, just getting onto the book side, I was also very lucky, you know, when people live in the future and are dreamers and not doers. I was very lucky a few years ago. I sat on a flight from Charlotte to LA, and I sat next to this guy. I was up in business class, and I sat next to this guy, white-haired guy, white beard, quite a grumpy kind of guy, actually. And we sat down in our seats. It was quite a grumpy guy. And we sat down in our seats, and this lady came on the plane, and she looked at the guy next to me with the white beard, and she said, "I think you're in my seat." And we all kind of looked at each other, and she said, "Oh, you know what, don't worry about it. I'll sit in your seat." What was it, 2B? And he said, "Yeah." So who was I sitting next to? Unbelievably, I was sitting next to Ted Med on TED creator Richard Saul Wurman. So
oh, wow.
I could not believe my luck. So, you know, we're just about to taxi, and his phone goes, and I look down, it's Tony Robbins, and he speaks to Tony for like 2 minutes. It's a true story. And then his phone goes again, and it, you know, I look down, it's Quincy Jones, the songwriter. And I think, who the heck is this guy? You know, anyway, it turned out it was Richard Saul Wurman. So anyway, we get up, and this is a great lesson for everybody on the phone. We get up into the sky. And he said, you know, he asked me about my job, my profession, and, you know, I obviously found out who he was. And he said to me, you know, so what's left for you? And I said, well, I'm still very ambitious. And after I said the word ambitious, he kind of grabbed my arm and he said, I never want you to say the word ambition again. And I said, really? And now, I mean, my parents had brought me up on ambition, right? And I thought, well, I've got to stick around, and not that I could leave the plane, but I've got to stick around and hear this. So he said, look, he said, to be ambitious and to dream things is the easiest thing in the world. I want a great car. I want a beautiful wife, you know, kind husband. I want to have money in the bank. And, you know, they are the intentions. They are the ambitions. Now, anyone can write goals down. But like Jim Rowan said time and time again, it's the discipline that counts. So what Richard Saul Wurman taught me, he said, look, every day of your life, just try and do good work. And then at the end of your career, let them say of you, hey, that must have been a really ambitious person. But of course, you were more process orientated. So that was a great lesson that I learned from Richard Saul Wurman, just on a chance meeting. But, you know, getting into the book side, you know, as entrepreneurs and business leaders and just personal growth you know, experts, we've all got to have two lenses. You've got to have a big picture lens and you've got to have a small picture lens. The big picture lens is to say, is the intention, is the ambition. Okay, I want to have a $3 million a year business. Right, let's go for it. That's the easy part. Now you've got to put the small lens on and you've got to look at what you've got to do to create those steps. Start with the end in mind. Now, if you're, I'm a big picture person, Kyle. I mean, you only have to look at my books. You know, I'm a very visual, you know, I see things in complete pictures. That's why in my whole career, I've surrounded myself with small picture people that can work up to. So, you know, if you can't do it yourself, please, please, please hire people that can make the big picture happen for you. You direct it. So, you know, there's a couple of nuggets straight out the gate there.
Well, there's three phases, right? So the first phase is work hard, right? And the second one was trust. You want to talk a little bit more about and then third phase.
Yeah, so the second one's trust. Now, for everyone on the call, there's a huge difference linguistically between the word belief and the word faith. Belief takes its origin from the Anglo-Saxon leaf, L-I-E-F, and leaf means to wish for. Okay, now, when you hear people, and I hear it in sport all the time, I believe in my daughter or I believe in my son, I believe I can make the putt, I believe I can do this. It's kind of wishy-washy, and belief is really clinging onto, it's not letting go. Belief is wishing, which is the origin of the word. Now, if you have faith, you've really, and this is the second phase, you've really done the groundwork and you've really done the process where you can actually let go. So belief is clinging to and holding on to and, you know, never letting go, right? You know, but faith is a completely different proposition. And faith is really about the ability to let go and let it all happen because you've done the work prior to the activity. Does that make sense?
100%. Love it.
Right. So then we go on to other aspects like, you know, fear. Now, you know, when we all embark upon a new venture, and this is all in phase two in the book, fear is a perspective of the unknown. You know, there's an acronym for fear, which is false evidence appearing real, okay? False evidence appearing real, and that's fear. So the answer to it all is preparation and planning, okay? If you can prepare and you can plan, okay, that is going to do you absolute wonders. Now, once again, a nice little nugget for everyone on the call is that our brain, I did this with Justin Rose. I could not have taken Justin Rose to European number one and world number five without what I'm going to tell you right now. Now, the brain works in various different cycles. You have alpha waves, beta waves, and theta waves, and delta waves. You know, there's many different waves. Now, if you can get into a wave called a theta wave, then what your imagination conjures up, you can actually physically manifest. Okay, I'll give an example. In 1968 at the Olympics, we had a very famous long jumper in Britain, and there was a rain delay. And time again, he would practice his breathing whilst he was in the shelter, and he would see all of the steps he would take till the jump point, and then he would see himself jumping. And he would replay this movie over and over again whilst breathing very succinctly and deliberately. Well, when the rain stopped, this the athlete would run up, take his jump, and he broke the world record. Now, that is a perfect marriage between what your imagination can conjure up and actually making it a physical reality. So when it comes to actually preparing for the event or the business or the meeting that you're going to have or anything else, okay, if you just take that 1% of the day that I referred to earlier, that 14 minutes, 15 minutes, sit in a chair, start to breathe from the stomach up to the lungs, and then start to visualize, how do I want to be? How do I want to act? How do I want to sound? What do I want to say? Okay, if you can do that for 14, 15 minutes, okay, I promise you, that will make the world of difference, okay? You'll go into a theta wave cycle, and what your imagination can conjure up will actually become your reality.
Are you more in a meditative state? Or how much is your brain working and you're visualizing versus letting it kind of come to you?
Yeah, so in this case, there's two types of meditation. There's meditation where you literally open up your mind and lay it bare to the universe, right? In those kind of circumstances, you're letting your thoughts just swim around. They come and go, and you're not putting any value on them. You're literally letting your mind run wild. Okay, let it go where it wants to go. But when you're doing this sort of activity, when you're in a theta wave, you absolutely need to, you know, how do I want to feel? How do I want to look? So you can actually start to conjure up and pre-program what your body and your mind and your verbosity, you know, everything that you want it to do. It's very powerful.
Very good. Nice.
Yeah, very powerful. So the devil's in the detail there. So, you know, try and create a hierarchy of influence. You know, acknowledge there are some areas that you may need professional help or mentoring. Be aware that you might feel impatient. I mean, there's something in my career that I've struggled with all of my career until I understood, Kyle, where impatience came from. Now, I mean, if everyone is very honest with themselves on this call, probably 8/10 of them are impatient people. Now, impatience comes from two areas. The first area is that because we are human beings, our thoughts come into our mind in very linear fashions. So it's a little bit like trains coming into a train station. Okay, so you can only get one train at a time at the station, and that is exactly like our thoughts. Okay, so if you've got a thought that's kind of like three or four carriages down, your logic cannot understand why you're not dealing with it now, but it's just not in the hierarchy because we think in a linear fashion. The second reason why we get impatient is, especially for me, is because if you're a big picture person and you can see everything done in its entirety, you can see the finished job, you can see the finished business, you can see how you want your team to be, but it's not there yet. Again, your logic cannot work out why you're not there yet, so impatience sort of ensues as well. So, you know, patience is may not be a virtue. I've never met an entrepreneur or I've never met a top sportsman who's not impatient. Everyone wants to get there, but you've got to also temper it with logic and why you can't get it right now. So, you know, that's the key.
And I think what I've witnessed from you on that, because for, you know, 3 or 4 years, we've had things we were going to go do, and then we just hit a wall. I know one of the top promoters in Las Vegas for all the casinos is a huge fan of yours. He read one of your books. The book that you have, your first bestseller, Seven Laws of the Golf Swing, I think you sold hundreds of thousands of copies of that. And I know we started hitting some walls. You know, there's legal, there's all these different things. And it was one of Andrew Lanois' really good friends in Las Vegas that really had the clout to bring you in, have you work with the top people, but they were busy, you were busy, I was busy, Andrew was busy, and we just didn't see it through. But what I noticed with you on multiple things we've talked about in the past is you're very unattached. It doesn't mean you're not, you know, there is, we all, I love how you talked about the impatience, but the difference, I think, is being unattached, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, John Lennon had the line in one of his songs, you know, life is what happens to you whilst you're busy making other plans, right? And
right.
And you know, sometimes, guys, you know, you know, once again, you want to do so many things. But I think what I've learned from my billionaire businessmen, especially those, and the top golfers, Kyle, is that once you've found your niche, once you've found your, you know, what you're really good at, you know, I mean, let's take a guy like Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney has been writing songs since he was 12 years old. And he's now 75, 76. Guess what he's doing? He's still writing songs. He didn't try and become, you know, something that he could never become. So part of life is discovering what you're really good at and keep doing it, and then also discover what you're really bad at and never do it again. Right?
Exactly.
So, you know, I think with that, you know, sometimes there's loads of things you want to do in your life. And, you know, my wife always says to me, you know, Nick, on your epitaph, it's going to say one life was never going to be enough. Right. And she's probably going to be correct in that. But the reality is always work to your strengths. You know, my second mentor was a great guy called Professor Colin Turner, and he said to me, you imagine the kid at school who's really good at math but very bad at English. So what happens is, you know, the teachers all say to this kid, right, you know, you've got to try better at English. So what happens is, you know, he spends less time in math, so math comes down to average, and English goes from bad to average. So what you've done now is you've just made an average student. Well, we're the same in life. If we start taking away from our strengths and not playing to those, and we start to get things that are definitely our weaknesses, we are actually in danger of just becoming an average person. Find out your strengths and just push hard and keep going in that direction.
Very good. Well, hey, I want to leave time for some Q&A, but I have a couple of more quick questions because, I mean, I could definitely fall back on the things working with the different billionaires you work with and some of those lessons. So we'll keep that in our pocket if we have time for it. But two other things, you know, you introduced me to an amazing guy, Morgan Mason. And I'll let you talk about Morgan. But did Morgan in some ways kind of lead you to me because you were searching out someone for Alan Watts? Or and how did you get to know Morgan? Tell us that story.
Yeah, so Morgan and I have been best friends for over 12, 13 years, and Morgan bought my first book, The Seven Laws of the Golf Swing. Morgan was living in the south of France, and I was still in London. And Morgan just sent me an email and said, look, you know, I'm an avid golfer. Would you fly down and work with me for a couple of days? So, you know, I got on a plane. I flew down to Nice in the south of France, and I worked with Morgan. And yeah, it just so happens that we had tons of common interests. I mean, I'm a huge, you know, obviously being from London, I'm a huge James Bond fan. Well, you know, Morgan's father was the famous actor James Mason, and James Mason was actually going to be the first James Bond. It was just the fact that at that time they were only offering a 3-film deal, and James Mason only did one film at a time. Had it not been James Mason, Sean Connery would not have been the first James Bond. James Mason would have been. So that was one thing. And then, you know, a lot of spiritual stuff. And so, you know, whether it was, you know, Alan Watts or, you know, for example, Morgan used to manage Deepak, you know, back in the day. So, you know, there was always that kind of spiritual element between the two of us. And, you know, it's so nice when you're on the level with someone, you don't have to try and impress them, or, you know, as impressive as Morgan is in his world as a film producer, you know, and a child actor with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton and everything, and as impressive as I was in the world of sport, you know, we just dropped all of that and we just got on great. And then, you know, the way that I got introduced to you was that I was I was looking for basically, and through Jim Rowan, I was looking for a mentor and someone that I could speak to on a regular basis. And so I got contacted with you, and we've developed a great friendship over 3 or 4 years. And then I introduced Morgan to you. And this is the way that life works. You know, it works through mutually getting on with people that have similar interests to you. And we're all very interested in basically maximizing our lives. So it's a lovely trilogy between the three of us.
Yes, so true. And yes, Morgan came to one of our LA inner circles, and the next day he and I and Robert Helms and Steve Fisher went to interview Phil Collin at his house. And Morgan and I were going to do a podcast together, but we ended up doing that interview, rode back, and then he's showing me pictures of, you know, at age 24, he worked for Ronald Reagan in the White House. And he was showing me pictures of being on Air Force One. And then he was the first $100 million indie film when he was in his 20s. And Richard Branson was his partner. And this is the late 80s. Then worked with, like you said, Deepak, and was running parts of William Morris. But one thing I didn't know was we're talking back at the hotel, and he starts doing the moonwalk. And he said, Michael Jackson literally taught me this because I ran the Michael Jackson 5 tour, stadium tour. And I'm like, what? There's more? And then the thing that really connects him with people, in addition to James Mason, is his wife is Belinda Carlisle of the Go-Go's, 30-year marriage.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they travel the world. And yeah, so I remember the first time you and I met, you got on the call with Morgan talking about Alan Watts, and, you know, maybe there was some potential synergy because of my Jim Rohn world. But Morgan's been an amazing guy, and just, again, shows you the caliber of person you are, right, to be best friends with Morgan. And, again, some of the different projects that have been brought up, again, just the being unattached. You know, that's what I've noticed. It's like, hey, let's give this a shot, but we're not going to, you know, we're just going to let it come together. Instead of trying to chase it, we're going to attract it.
Yeah, I think any time, I mean, the analogy is, you know, if you try and force a lock with a key, you're going to break the key. You know, if something's meant to happen, Kyle, you know, it's going to flow. It's going to be effortless. It's going to be the right time at the right place, you know. Opportunity is luck, meeting preparation. So, you know, I just feel that when that certain event or when those events are going to happen, you know what, it's going to be, you know, it's going to feel right at the right time. And if it hasn't happened, then hey, you know what, let it go. You know, there are tons of opportunities around the corner. You just got to keep your eyes open.
Absolutely. And the last thing I want to ask you real quick is you're doing some things with the Golf Channel, right? And your, Ryder Cup, the Europe Ryder Cup team, the Golf Channel. You're also, you relocated from North Carolina to Atlanta, working with one of the big golf courses. Anything along those lines you want to share?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, that's a perfect example of what we just talked about, you know, okay. So, you know, a beautiful saying, you know, show me an overnight success and I'll show you 25 years of hard work behind
exactly.
it, right?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, so I've been in my 25th year of being an elite coach and mentor. I got approached by the Golf Channel and Sky TV to start commentating and doing all the swing analysis on the live TV. So, for example, I'm going to be in Charlotte the first week of May covering the Wells Fargo Championship. So when I go out live, I'm speaking in front of 2 million live viewers on TV, talking, you know, doing various swing analysis and mental preparation and, you know, talking about the events of the thing. So, you know, and I'm very comfortable doing that because, you know, as I suggest in the book, you know, it's all about preparation. And, you know, I've been preparing for these moments for 20, 25 years of my life. So I really enjoy the TV work. I really don't get nervous, you know, in live TV because I know that I've prepared pretty thoroughly. And I've got a new book coming out this year called Letters to an Evolving Golfer. And they are 100 essays of basically 25 years of of wisdom that I've picked up from working with these business guys and the top golfers, and even, you know, some of our conversations, Kyle, are going to be in there for sure.
Wonderful. Well, you know, the other thing I did want to touch on, and then we will definitely open up for Q&A, and this, I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, but you were on Top of the World, and then 2009, you had a, you know, a life tragedy happen, and it took you for a little bit of a loop, obviously, and then as you and I were talking last week, you said, okay, all these things I've had to apply to golf, I've now had to really take it to the next level and apply to my life. So if you could share a little bit about that, I think it definitely would help some of the people who are going to listen to this call.
Absolutely. I don't mind talking about it now at all. So I was coming back from Orlando, Florida. I'd just been doing some work with Justin Rose, U.S. Open champion, and I landed in Wilmington, North Carolina, and the car, I was driving out of the airport, and my phone went, and it was my brother, and he said, you know, what are you doing? And I said, I'm driving in the car. And he said, well, you know, you might need to pull over. And, I either thought, okay, we've won the Powerball, right? or something,
right.
something bad has happened. So in typical Nick Bradley fashion, I kept driving, but I said I'd pulled over. so he said, look, I've got something, you know, bad to say. And I said, well, what is it? He said, well, you know, Dad's dead, my father. And I said, you know, what happened? And it transpired that he had taken his own life. He had committed suicide. And only the previous day had he literally, his last words to me were, Nick, you know, just remember, I love you very much. And that was it. We kind of hung up the telephone. And the next day, you know, I get that phone call. So, you know, at that time, I had the world at my feet. You know, I was probably the best golf instructor in the world. You can Google it and everything. You know, I was a hero for getting back Justin Rose. I'd just taken Kevin Chappell from UCLA. You know, he won on tour and then finished fifth at the U.S. Open. And, you know, everything was going good. And then, bingo, you know, that event happened. So it affected me very deeply. I wouldn't say it affected me first, you know, for the first 4 or 5 months, but it started to show up in my work. And, you know, almost one day I started to get panic attacks. I started to get anxiety attacks. I started to get heart palpitations, you know, and I'm a pretty fit guy. And, you know, if someone had told me, and this, you know, this is one of the lessons to me, Nick Bradley, is that someone had said to me, hey, listen, I suffer from anxiety or I suffer from panic attacks. I, you know, pre-2009, I would have thought they were a little bit weak, okay, a little bit soft, a little bit weak, you know, and I thought, you know, just get over it. But I can tell you, I'll tell you, everyone on this call, that having a panic attack, a genuine one, or an anxiety attack, or heart palpitations, is nothing to do with you in your consciousness. Okay, as Daniel Kahneman says in Thinking Fast and Slow, you've got self one and self two, right? This is nothing to do with self one, like your conscious awake state. This is something very primal, because you are being threatened. And so, you know, I would be shaking, my heart would be racing. I went to four cardiologists in 6 months, and every one of them told me to get out of the office because I was fit and I was just having panic attacks. But no one could give me the answer. So, Kyle, all of this stuff that I've been teaching people for 25 years, I looked in the mirror one day and I thought, my God, I've got to start coaching myself. You know, John Lennon said, you've got to find your own temple. And it's absolutely true, right? You've got to deal with it. No, someone's going to help you a little bit of the way, but no one apart from yourself is going to get you over the finish line. So I'll tell you what happened. One day, as you know, Kyle, I've got a couple of huskies. I love huskies. I love my dogs, right? I live by one of the most beautiful beaches in the world, and I'm walking on the beach with my dogs, with my daughter, and I'm literally shaking uncontrollably from having a panic and anxiety attack. And I looked at my daughter, and I looked at my dogs, and I absolutely submitted, and I just said to myself, you know what? If you want to take me, you know, if you want to, you know, kill me right now, do your worst, you know, I just don't care anymore. I just don't care. And there we go back to faith and belief, right? So we just completed the circle there. And I literally walking down my bit, and I said, you know, I'm fed up with you. I'm not going to fight you anymore. I'm going to let go. If you want to give me a heart attack, if you want to make me crazy, that's fine, but I'm not fighting anymore. Well, I promise you now, within 2 days, I didn't have heart palpitations, I didn't have an anxiety attack, and I didn't have a panic attack anymore, because I submitted and I let go of the rock in the stream and I just went downstream. And that, my lesson to everybody on this call is that when you're challenged, sometimes it's not a good idea to butt heads with the challenge. Sometimes it's better to let go and just realize that some things are just part of the human condition, just part of the human malady. We are meant to suffer from these things. We're not meant to be perfect people, and that is it. But when you let go and you submit a little bit, all of a sudden you can float away, and you just, the fight has ended. The fight has ended, and that's my story. I mean, that is it. I mean, it's very powerful. I mean, there was some other stuff as well there. But I went through denial. I went through all the stages. I went through denial. I went through incredible anger. I went through, you know, obviously the anxiety and the panic. And then I came out the other side because I just said, you know, screw this. I'm done with it. I'm just letting go. And guess what? Within 3 days, all of that junk had stopped. And you're going to be faced with fear, false evidence appearing real. And that is what anxiety is. And that is what panic attacks are. And that is what heart palpitations are. They are false evidence appearing real. Let go and just submit.
So, and I guess that would apply also with relationships, right? You can't control another person. So as a husband, as a father, as a, you know, working with people in your world, have you found that's the case as well at times?
Yeah, I think we're at our worst when we're trying to please somebody and become somebody else to, you know, fit in with someone else's plan. I think if you look at marriage, you know, most people grow apart in a marriage because you forget who you were in the early days. You've lost your identity. You know, I think the most dangerous thing in a marriage is to become one identity, because, you know, you're almost, familiarity breeds contempt. I think if you keep your identity and your personality and meet in the middle occasionally, I mean, I'm a guy that for 25 years, I've spent a lot of time on the road. You know, a lot of time away from my family and my wife, but when I come back, man, you know, it's fresh, it's good. You know, I think there's an absolute argument, you know, some wisdom in saying, well, you've got to have some separation to come back and feel fresh again. So yeah, don't be afraid of letting go in some of those circumstances, for sure.
Yeah, and especially expectations too that we have of other people. So, Nick, you are such a wealth of knowledge and wisdom and experience, and I know you're just talking from the tip of the iceberg of what you know. It's so, you know, it's just flowing out of you, right? These aren't canned answers, so I love that. I wanted to open it up real quickly to Q&A. Guys, sure. Don't be shy. Let's jump in. So if you have questions, you've got a world-class guy here. Take advantage of the opportunity to ask Nick anything that we've talked about tonight or anything else that comes to mind.
Hey, Nick, this is Iñaki. I just want to say thank you very much for, you know, sharing your story. And I'm in the book with you, The One Thing That Changed Everything. So no questions. Just want to say that I feel honored that I'm part of a project with you and Kyle Wilson.
Thank you very much. And I can't wait to actually get my hands. I've read the manuscript online, but, you know, a book for me has to be in my hand. So I can't wait to get my copy, which is coming soon. So it's a pleasure to be in the book with you too, sir.
Iñaki is amazing. I probably will. Are you 27 or younger or older, Iñaki?
26.
26. I was going to say 26, and there's no way you can be 26 because this guy is so mature and just an amazing guy. And, you know, I love millennials. This guy's hard at it. He's attended a couple of the Inner Circle meetings as well. So, Iñaki, I'll see you next week. At the Robert Helms event. So that's awesome. Great to have you on the call.
Can't wait.
questions for Nick.
Hey, Nick.
Hi, yes, this is Felicia. Oh. Sorry about that.
Hi, Felicia.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Hi. Nick, I'm a physician, and I'm just listening to you with your, after your dad died and your panic attacks and what was going on. Do you think that there was anything that any of those doctors could have said to you that could have brought you to that realization faster?
No. No, because, you know, in my experience of that, and obviously with world-class athletes as well, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And that is the same with a lot of self-correction as well. And, you know, to be honest with you, a lot of over-medication as well. You know, I believe that once you understand and you accept that a lot of maladies in life are just part of the human condition, you can actually just fall away and just kind of let them go a little bit with a more stoic sort of approach. You know, it would be the easiest thing in the world for me to say, okay, look, medicate me out of this, you know, hell, right? But, you know, I knew that I really, to authentically conquer it, I had to come from the inside out, not the outside in. So there's nothing, you know, and I'm a pretty shrewd guy, like my trust level, you know, that's why I love my relationship with Kyle, because I trust him implicitly. I don't let a lot of people in. You know, so for me, I would rather tackle something on my own terms to a degree until I let someone else in. So I can tell you now that if you're a physician, my panic attacks were so bad that I could actually feel my adrenal glands, which are located just behind the kidneys there, you know, by the rib. I could actually feel them pumping, you know, every day. You know, when I was going through this stuff. So, yeah, it's an interesting question that you pose. But for myself, I just relented and let go, and that psychological, you know, fight just came to an end, and it all started to dissipate.
I want to say I 100% agree with you that the majority of maladies are psychological, and psychological in air quotes. But you can take care of them. And I just haven't quite figured out how to get people to understand that. So I appreciate your candor.
Well, you know, it's a little, I'm not an expert on the Bible at all, but it's a little bit like the people, you know, they are the believers and they are the naysayers and they are, you know, the antagonists and they are, you know, so there are some people that you just, you know, I've seen it in golf. I mean, I've had a couple of real disappointments. I've had students that are better than Tiger Woods, and I mean that. I've had one Canadian guy who hit it better than Tiger Woods ever would do, but I could not get him over the finish line mentally. And there are some people that you just have to realize that they, you know, that they're just not wired that way. And some people are, some people are not.
Thanks a lot.
Very good. Thanks. Thank you, Felicia. Who else? Quick question.
Hey, Nick. Luke Moore from Iowa. How's it going?
Hi, Luke. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks so much for sharing that story. That was pretty powerful. Golf question for you. Do you ever work with the fellow Iowan, Zach Johnson?
No, I know Zach Johnson's game very well, but I don't know him personally, no.
Oh, cool. I just thought that my buddy of mine married his sister, so kind of always following him.
Well, he's a very good golfer, and you know, relative to my quote earlier, he's a golfer that really truly understands his own identity and his own strengths, and he never tries to be someone else. You know, he's not the longest guy out there. Actually, he beat Justin Rose and I in 2007 at the Masters. We finished fifth, and Zach Johnson won. He beat us down the last two holes. So I admire Zach Johnson, but I didn't like him that year.
Thanks for sharing.
Pleasure.
Hey, and by the way, Luke's part of the One Thing book and has an amazing story. He got MS in his 20s. He's been working on overcoming
AML.
That. AML. I'm sorry. Thank you.
AML leukemia.
And,
yep.
Yes. And you have an amazing story. And I just, you know, so much courage, so much persistence. I encourage everyone to make sure and read Luke's story and The One Thing That Changed Everything. It's a powerful story. You know, where you're tying in family, health, and your business. So, but thanks for jumping on tonight, Luke.
Thanks,
Luke.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Kyle. Yep, thanks.
Harlan here.
Hey, Harlan.
Hey, Harlan.
How are you doing? Thank you for this, Nick. And I'm a pastor chaplain the last 43 years, and you really hit a home run on your understanding of faith and trust.
Mm-hmm.
I just really appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a big key. You know, even linguistically, you know, the difference between faith and belief. I always use the example of, you know, if you and I were in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we were going to do a free fall parachute jump, and my parachute packer said, you know, I believe I've fixed the parachute correctly. You know, there's no way on earth I'm getting that thing on my back and jumping out of a plane. But if your guy said, you know, I've got faith, I know what I'm doing, then there's a completely different feeling to that. You know, that one guy knows what he's doing, and the other guy is clinging, you know, to the hope that he knows what he's doing. And so, you know, there's a very big linguistic difference between faith and belief, and faith is really comes from the fact that you know on a very deep level, and you've got a great understanding. Belief is wishy-washy and clutching at straws.
That's you there. And I served a parachute packing company at one point, and the guys that did that had to jump their own chutes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say.
That's trust, that I did
you
it
know,
right.
If you jump out of a plane, you better have your chute together.
Thanks
Nick
again,
Bradley.
Nick.
Hey, thanks, Harlan.
Yep.
Thank you.
Question
hey, Nick
Bradley.
Hey, this is Tara Bolzinger. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Todd.
Hi.
I think you jumped in first.
Hi, Nick. This is Todd Solzinger from California.
Hey, Todd.
I was curious. Hi there. You work with some really high performers, and do you find on the whole that they're, you know, kind of good listeners, willing to learn, willing to take instruction, and how do you get through that working with people that are, again, like really talented high performers?
Yeah, I mean, I can absolutely say categorically that the best golfers, the best musicians, the best actors, the best businessmen. I can tell you at some point in their lives, they've been amazing students. You cannot blunder. Honestly, you cannot blunder into greatness. It goes back to my saying, you know, show me an overnight success, I'll show you 25 years of hard graft, right? You cannot blunder in. So, you know, if you want to be great at something, you just cannot do it half-heartedly. You know, when Justin Rose, I started working with Justin Rose, he had literally come to the end of his tether. He was tanking. He, you know, his career, he had no idea about his diet. He used to eat pizza and Coke at tour events. And this is one of the best athletes in the world. You know, he had a school friend on his bag as a caddy. I fired him. I had to get a real caddy in. You know, and then I started doing meditation and hypnosis with him and started to change his golf swing. So, you know, you have to have someone who's very open to that sort of suggestion. And they, again, they would have had to have reached a point sometimes when they said enough is enough. It's like the Jim Rohn thing. A guy takes a shotgun to his car and says, that's the last time I'm ever looking at this thing, and blows it to smithereens. You have to get sometimes to a breaking point to realize, you know what, I'm in a corner. I can't go back anymore. I've just got to go forward. What do I need to do?
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you very much for that.
Love that. And by the way, Nick, Todd had he changed it now, but he had on his profile a picture of a golf swing. So you got a golf fan right there.
I'll look at it later. So,
Takara.
Yes,
hi.
I'm Takara.
Hey, hey.
I thank you for telling your story about your experience with your father's suicide and your anxiety and then leading to your surrender. It's really interesting because that's really been my theme for the last week. So I'm learning a lot about this right now. But my question is, when you had that moment of surrender, was it a one and done thing, or did you have to continue to make that decision, and did you need tools to help you make that decision? as you went forward, and what were they?
Great question. So, I can honestly say that day when I just relented, I would say within 2 to 3 days, I noticed a significant difference. I mean, I was having a heart palpitation probably every 4 minutes. And, it goes, that would be the heartbeat. And, after that decision was made, I didn't notice one for a couple of days. And then occasionally, another way that I used to combat it, sometimes I used to be asleep at night and I would like wake up and I'd like jump out of bed and I'd be sweating and everything. Well, in the future, when that happened again, I used to just kind of like laugh at it. And again, say, okay, well, you're there again. I can see you. It's no problem. Leave me alone. I'm fine now. So, I just started, rather than being overly concerned about it, and actually, because it's so primal and it becomes, I actually conquered it through understanding the part of the brain that was creating it. It's called the hypothalamus. And there's a little almond-shaped gland in the middle of the brain. And when I start to understand what this hypothalamus used to do, I used to say, right, okay, I know what it's doing. Once I know what it's doing, it's trying to protect me. I can say, okay, good job, just get on with it. And as soon as I had that level of understanding, it's like people who don't like flying. If you actually research how efficient engines are and lift and actually look at the science of flying, you're going to have to be super unlucky ever to get in a plane crash. I mean, really unlucky. So,
right.
Once you demystify it, you take its power away. Okay? So, if you demystify something, you take its power away and it no longer has control over you. So, yeah, there were a couple of things. I used to sit down, meditate for 14 minutes and just, keep letting go deeper and deeper and just realizing that, it's a human malady, that I'm not in control of it. It's something very primal. Once I've really understood it on a deeper level, I could let go of it even more. It's when you don't understand something and it starts to badger you and becomes confusing, you get overly concerned and now it becomes an issue.
Awesome. Wow. Okay. Thank you.
So just whatever your problem is, demystify it, unravel it, okay, and see it in the cold light of day and it loses its power, I promise you.
Boom. Thank you.
Pleasure.
So we only have a few more minutes left. Who has a question for Nick before we wrap
Richard
it up?
Richard Hay here.
This is
hey,
Lynn.
Hey, Nick, it's kind of a quick question, I think. So you talk about, people need to follow their strengths. How do you get through to people that believe that they absolutely have to focus on every weakness and it takes that 95% of their time when that 5% could take them over the top?
Well, generally if someone's had a strength in their life, you can point to some significant evidence of that. So I always, in my coaching and my teaching, I talk about the two E's, evidence and experience, right? So if someone has had a strength in their life and it's been very clear, you just turn them back to it. It's like Sigmund Freud used to say, okay, if you've got a problem now, right, let's go, or a problem in your past, let's say, my father's event, let's say in 2009, okay, which is 9 years ago. If I want to kind of like get rid of that, I actually go to a point beyond, before that, say 2005, and realize what a great time I had with him then, rather than, so you kind of like, you go back in time and you go back, so when you've got someone who's got a clear strength, if you can actually get them back to that moment where that strength was demonstrated and you say, look, clearly this is, can you not see the truth in this? Then we get back to the point where they either are or they're not. And if they're not, then maybe try 2 or 3 times to do it. And if they don't want to do it, please let go. With my students, if I ask someone to do something 2 or 3 times, that's about my limit. because if they truly want to do it, they would do it normally on the first go or certainly the second go. So, you know, if you have someone in your life who's uber talented at something, but they're not realizing that talent or that strength, then, you know, try and get them to realize a point in history when they demonstrated it. If that doesn't work, try and talk to them a couple of times and say, look, you know, you're really good at this. And you know what? If they don't get it then, you're just going to have to accept that you can't get them over the finish line sometimes.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Lynn.
Oh, hi. Thank you. And
hello.
Thanks for being on this call. How are you, Nick? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm honored to be part of the book as well. And I guess my question is, quickly, is what would be the one thing that you might think about if you were looking to reinvent yourself?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. If I was looking to reinvent myself, are you talking about a total 360 if I needed money or didn't need money?
Yes.
The reason why I ask that is because there's always, listen, as much as we like to dream and plan and have intentions, there's always a pragmatic thing going on, isn't there? Okay, so
yes.
My question is, so if I really wanted to reinvent myself and money was no object, then again, I would picture myself going into a library and saying, okay, what three books would I pick out first? You know, if I was in a library, what books would I read all day? What subject matter would I not get tired of? And that would probably give me a really good clue of what I wanted to do if money was no object. Now, I can tell you, I can reveal on this call that if 3 or 4 years down the line, I get tired of this journey, and there's a lesson as well. Never feel that you're obligated to the journey you're on. You know, if you want to change lanes, change lanes. Now, if I feel that I want to change lanes at some point in the future, I will do. And I've always wanted to be, you know, I've always liked clinical psychology. I've always liked being, you know, a mentor, and all of those things really fire me up. So, you know, from a pragmatic point of view, if I did need money, I would reinvent myself and certainly become more of a business guru than I am now to my clients. So to answer the question, if you had a student or someone, okay, if I sat you in a library, what books would you naturally gravitate to? Well, that's probably a good clue.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. And so, Nick, I want to take a couple of minutes and just find out how people can get a hold of you. And also just want to mention, I mean, I know the last time I sent you, you know, hey, I'm out here in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and I'm playing on a golf course. And you're like, Kyle, if you'll send me videos or if you'll come spend an hour with me, I can take 15 strokes off your game. I mean, you're very confident about your ability to help people. So, tell us how they can get a hold of you, but also talk about if someone wanted to get a foursome or an eight people and come to Atlanta and spend a couple of days. Because I know I've talked with you about that, either having you come here, but again, you tell me you got this amazing golf course there. Or anything else. If people want to have you come speak, you spoke at my Brian Tracy 3-day event. So any of the above, how they can get a hold of you and a little bit about what that would look like if they wanted to have you coach them for half a day or a day.
Great. Well, everybody, I'm the director of instruction at the beautiful Reynolds Lake Oconee in Greensboro, Georgia. We have 6 championship golf courses. We have a beautiful Ritz-Carlton hotel that overlooks the lake, a beautiful 300-bedroom hotel. And my directorship is over a point in the facility called the Kingdom, where we offer just amazing golf instruction and club fitting. To get hold of me is really easy. My email address, which Kyle can give out anyway, is nrbradleygolf@gmail.com. Very simple. nrbradleygolf@gmail.com. That's my private personal email. And yeah, to Carl's point, you know, I have groups here all the time. In fact, I've got one of my clients, one of my banker clients tomorrow from Barbados coming in for a couple of days instruction. So, you know, we've got 300-bedroom Ritz-Carlton Hotel. We've got 70 condos, luxury condos. We've got 45 luxury cottages. We've got 6 restaurants on site. So, we have a beautiful facility here. So, if anyone wants to put something together golf-wise, then just contact me, and I'd love to help you out. And whether it's just nothing to do with golf, it's sit down mentoring, talking, then we can do that.
And I mentioned the group just to help. I mean, your day rate's pretty pricey, right? But if they got a group of 4 or 8, they could turn it into a weekend, and it becomes a no-brainer at that point in time, right?
Totally. So, you know, the way that I've run my business over 25 years is that I would take everyone's individual handicap. For example, some of my business guys, they started with me at 25 handicap, and I've got them down to 13 within 7 months. So that's a pretty big jump in golfing. That's a pretty big jump in golfing terms. So, I create a timeline. Okay, we're going to do it in this amount of time. You're going to get this much improvement. And let's engage and let's go for it. And so, you know, in my world of golf instruction, there's a lot of ambiguity. It's kind of like, you know, there's no real goal setting, and there's no benchmarks, no finish lines. I'm completely the opposite to that, where I say, look, this is where I want to take you. Let's step on the gas and go for it. So my facilities are some of the best in the world. I mean, it's totally amazing. Just look at Reynolds Lake Oconee and be prepared to be blown away.
So, Nick, just love it. And I love your personal development hunger that you have. And it's obvious that you're a teacher. And, yeah, I definitely see you impacting lots of audiences, over and beyond just golf, right? Talking mental the mental dynamics and achievement and setting goals and visualization. So it's been an honor to have you on the call tonight. And guys, why don't you unmute yourself and let's give Nick a big, huge thank you for investing an hour in all of us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Kyle.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks to
everyone.